was a big recession in 74, 75. But even earlier than that, in 73, the big corporations were getting together and saying, hey, we're making big profits, but it's not big enough. And they really wanted to push more. They already had big globalization, but they wanted to intensify it. They wanted to hurt unions by going to other countries and trying to find ways, which took time, but they did find ways to, subsidize through the governments they control, the big corporations, travel, certain types of travel, certain types of deregulation, finding pools of cheap labor in countries with no environmental or very little environmental regulation to exploit, and then push the production over there for the cheap labor and the lack of environmental, lack of taxes, and all that kind of stuff. So all that kind of stuff falls under neoliberalism. It's capitalism. It's the same capitalism that existed in the post-war upswing, but it's capitalism on the offensive rather than, and neoliberalism is an apt term in some ways because liberals led this offensive. If you look back to where neoliberalism started in the United States, it really started under the Carter regime with people like Kennedy and all these liberal icons, Tsongas and so on, leading the charge of deregulation over utilities, trucking, airlines, et cetera, to create more profits for the capitalists, to privatize, to hurt working people, basically. So people that had, in the post-war upswing, started to get jobs in, say, a company like AT&T or a publicly owned utility, or in the airline industry that was heavily unionized and getting heavily unionized, all of a sudden they would break unions to say the company's out of business, reform, remonopolize, all that stuff, also neoliberalism. Every regime, Republican or Democrat, embraces neoliberalism. Obama's big bailout was for the big banks, not for you and me, right? Not for you losing your house, not for you living in your car. It was for the big corporations, the big bosses. That's what that was. So here we go to millennials. Again, not news for some of us, but important information you got to use in your arguments with people, in your discussions with people, in your own education, perhaps, if you're not that far along with the socialist perspective. The next recession will destroy millennials. This is by Anne Lowry from citylab.com/life, www.citylab.com, and ultimately from Reuters, Max Whitaker. You find a lot of stuff online now with multiple sources. She's from The Atlantic. Reuters was part of it or picked it up or something. A little unclear, actually, what Reuters had to do with this, because this was mainly written by Anne Lowry from The Atlantic. But anyway, quote, millennials are already in debt and without savings. Yeah, we kind of know that, unfortunately. After the next downturn, they'll be in even bigger trouble. So there is a talk of recession out there. And I find this interesting because in past times where a recession was looming, the powers that be, the big corporations, the government, they were not, the government controlled by the big corporations here, they were not actually talking much about it. And sometimes they are surprised, even with all their information gathering, they are surprised when a recession hits. You know, like, for example, let's go back to 98, 99. This was a 2-year period under the Clinton regime where there, by the way, I got to have to do the legal ID here. This is WMFO Medford or WMFO in Medford. And we call ourselves Touch Free Forum, commercial free community based radio. You're listening to a slice of that community radio. This is social alternative radio, talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. And Tufts Radio, Tufts Free Forum, Tufts Educational Radio. I like that one. We're at 91.5 FM, and we're at our call site, again, WMFO, or station identification WMFO, and you can go to WMFO.org or listen to us over the air. And we're located up in the bucolic hills of Tufts University, Medford/Somerville border. So you get us on the radio, great. You get us online, that's good. WMFO.org. Anyway, there are times when recession is a bit of a surprise. 1998-99 was this two-year period, a very anomalous period, in that because of an inflationary spiral in the dot-com economy. Remember all those websites that didn't really produce anything and all that kind of stuff, and big business trying to retool along using computers in various ways and using the internet in various ways. You had a lot of fictitious capital running around, meaning money being spent on things that didn't really produce things, okay? Well, it's just the speculation that always exists under capitalism and is very bad right now. You know, currency speculation and all that. A lot of waste under capitalism, a lot of wasted capital, a lot of wasted, because capital is the unpaid wages of the working class. So you have a lot of wasted labor under capitalism, a lot of wasted value, okay? In 98-99, you had the same thing going on, but intensified by a new technology being brought in, the use of the internet and the and more use of computers and so on. So, personal computers and so on. So, you actually look back and you see wages actually snuck up a little bit for working people in 98-99. Now, so what are the economists saying now? They're saying that for the past 30 or 40 years, wages have been stagnant, right? And that's true, because they're talking about the general trend, stagnant or falling, right? But in 98-99, there was actually a little blip. And if some of you weren't alive then, or you were just children or whatever, you should have been around then. They were talking about, hey, it's the end of the business cycle. That means, you know, recession and boom periods. It's the end of the business cycle. How do we get here? What are we doing? You hear stuff like that now about inflation. Oh, inflation's not coming back. What do we do so wonderful about solving inflation? Well, let me tell you something. If you have education bills, if you have college costs that are 500% more over a decade, I'd say that's inflation, wouldn't you? Or, I don't know, or medical costs, you know, et cetera. Anyway, so whatever. They can cook the books on inflation, and there is some things that aren't, some prices that aren't being inflated based on what we were just talking about with intensified globalization and so on. But let's leave that aside. Just look at 98-99. Boom, all of a sudden, low unemployment. Not as low as now, by the way, but lower, right? Low unemployment. And relatively speaking, and increased wages. Oh, wow. And this was a time when unions were still under attack like they are now. There's a decline in unionization. How is this happening? Well, it was all a big bubble that was based on nothing, essentially, in the sense of a lot of capital being expended for goods and services not being produced. The potential was there. And maybe even realized in certain cases. And I knew people in Boston that worked for Oracle and other big high-tech firms, you know, many of which are out of business now. Small high-tech firms also out of business. A whole generation of people graduating college at that time who slid into startups, what they're calling now startups or venture capital. They weren't using those words so much then. And they were doing something on the web, usually nothing useful. And that all came crashing down because when you call in, say, the loans on a corporation that's not producing anything, then or that their thing they thought they were producing didn't work out. I know up close a company, it was some MIT people started in Central Square. I knew somebody working in this company, and they were going to create they were linguistics PhDs or people that were working on their PhDs to create an online program for, I can't remember exactly the details, but something to do with like some sort of, like, you know, hyperlinked, really efficient dictionary type thing that you could say Google probably figured out later on. And they couldn't sell their ultimate product after they dusted it all off after a lot of hard work, grinding work in some senses. They dusted off, they tried to sell it to, I think it was Barnes & Noble at the time, and they didn't get it. They didn't want it, so that company went completely out of business and shatter, creative destruction, quote unquote, haha. So that was sad. That multiply that, extrapolate that way a million times, and you have what was happening in the economy at that time, but still under the radar, and the corporations and the corporate media were not talking about recession. Then 2000 hits, and there's some rumblings. What's going on? A lot of navel gazing because, you know, of, you know, little bits and pieces of this anecdotally getting out. And there was also that, what was that thing about the, they were predicting a computer crash in 2000, which was a joke ultimately, but that reflected a truth, which was the anxiety and uneasiness about trying to, the corporations basically carving up public space on the internet for profit, but try to figure out how best to do that, and of course, how that would become monopolized. Everything becomes monopolized under capitalism. You can destroy monopolies, you can bring in a new technology or a new thing, it will become monopolized or re-monopolized under capitalism. That's the way it works. And then, or doesn't work, as the case may be, if you have the long-term view. So, So 98, 99, 2000, some rumblings, but still no clear articulation. 911 hits in 2001. That took up all the space for everything, just about analysis or whatever, and people went crazy over 911. I'm not saying that to belittle the terrorist attacks or say they weren't serious or whatever. I'm just saying that it just engulfed, you know, the stuff around that, the preparation for the inevitable war that would follow under capitalism and so on, just took up all the space. Then as the smoke started to clear a little bit, 2002, 2003, they looked back and said, oh, wait a minute. A recession kind of started in late, I think it was late 1999 or 2000. I have to double check that. But a recession was going on when people didn't know a recession was going on. Now we've got the corporate media talking about recession before it's even started, and saying it's going to be nasty for some people. And this is an article like that. And now, by the way, not all the corporate media is talking about this. Corporate media is talking about this, but it's just something that if you, you know, read, you know, business stuff, which I unfortunately do, and you read, you know, you listen to programs like Marketplace, which is really simplistic, but anyway, it's out there with some information. On National Propaganda Radio, you get some of this information, and it's here and there. Again, this is from The Atlantic, and somehow Reuters had something to do with it too. Millennials are already in debt without savings. I already mentioned that quote. After the next downturn, they'll be in even bigger trouble. So they list some bunch of things, trade wars dragging on. I mean, it's always trade wars under capitalism. That would be worth the whole show to get into, that there's always tariffs and stuff happening under capitalism. Is Trump making it worse? Absolutely. Trump makes everything worse. You know, the Trump regime makes everything worse. There's no debate on that. Is a Trump regime like inventing some new form of evil? No. They're not, unfortunately. Well, fortunately, I guess, if you want to look at it in a twisted way. They are just taking up old evils, like the constant. There's always tariffs, and they're riffing on that. And in a very incoherent way, you know, one as you know, with Trump, one day it'll be, we're going to do this policy, the next day it'll be, you know, we're taking back this policy because I like this person or something. You know, and again, I'm not reducing it to Trump. It's a whole regime. It's a whole economic system that is not, a lot of it is not averse to tariffs. You know, there are sections of the economy, steel and autos and so on, and some sections of those are like, bring them on, man, tariff the crap out of them. It depends how much they have invested in certain parts of the world that are being the targets of the tariffs. If a certain car company has, you know, 30% of its production in China, then they're not going to be so thrilled, you know. But a company has nothing invested directly in China, hey, tariff the heck out of that company. I'll get ahead. It's all about, they're sharks, basically, you know. They're going after each other all the time, even as they will defend the system collectively, too, as the, you know, a small minority of the population that are the capitalists. But there is a couple things they mentioned that I think are more to the point. Global growth is slowing. There are in the so-called investors, which is just the capitalists, are fleeing to safety, quote unquote. That means a lot of different things, but something that people have been studying lately in the contemporary capitalist economy, not just in the United States, but other places as well, is that the very rich capitalists, they have more money than they know what to do with. Now, you can picture that in your head in terms of personal consumption, right? If I was someone like Bill Gates, I couldn't even spend my money. I could spend every second of my day spending money, and I wouldn't spend all my quote unquote money. In other words, the money I've stolen from the labor of working people. It wouldn't happen. I wouldn't be able to get rid of it, right? They don't. They die, and, you know, they create another parasite class on society, or parasitic individuals on society through inheritance of our labor, of the money and value from our labor as workers. But what they also, as corporations, as capitalist running corporations and investing in corporations, what they can't find now is places where they're really sure that their profits will in the short term go up. So they kind of sit on the money, and they don't like doing that. They want money that makes money. So interest making money off interest rates isn't enough for the average capitalist, because there's another capitalist that might come and take over the things that they're investing in, and they want to keep their control over it. So they want places to make more money. They want to invest to make more money. It's part of what we talked about earlier in the show, constant need to grow under capitalism, even when growth is harming the heck out of people and the environment. And I'm not arguing for like no growth. Actually, under a democratic social society, you could have tons of growth, but with completely different accountability, meaning you'd have a real actual democracy. You'd have accountability, the democratic planning, and you'd have sustainable ways of growing and so on. But here we have a place now the capitalists can't figure out because they're so blinded by their short-term maximization of profit religion that they can't, I'm using that loosely, religion, not scientifically, and they can't figure out where that safe investment is going to be. That there are places already in the world that are unstable, right, from their point of view. And so even a place like China, kind of, you know, there's a lot of tons of capital invested in China. But the state capitalist regime in China, not communist, state capitalist, they are they're powerful, and they might decide to pass laws and regulations. And they have done this already, and it's made Apple and other corporations scream that the corporations are used to a certain rate of profit, and all of a sudden China discovers an environmental regulation somewhere that they actually want to implement. Boom. That hurts profits, and there. Now, where do you go next? Vietnam? Do you go to, Bangladesh, Pakistan? Where's that Indonesia? Where's that best cheap labor pool to exploit next? And that's tricky. That's tricky based on what they call geopolitical factors. You know, like, what's going on? What's our market share, trade routes, exploitable cheap labor, government situation there? You know, is that going to all work out? What's going on with Trump? The Trump regime, are they going to throw a tariff? If we open up a new factory in Jakarta, are they going to throw a tariff on that? Doesn't look like it. Okay, boom, you know, and all of a sudden thousands of people are out of work in China or here or Mexico or somewhere. And by the way, there are limits to that too, the mobility of capital. I'm not trying to make it seem like every capitalist enterprise can just jump and run and set up new operations wherever they feel. Many times they can't. Even when they say they can, they can't. And that's something that the labor movement has to often take a risk on. Although, unfortunately, there's a lot of labor leaders that don't take any risks, but have to take a risk on, you know. And the risk should always be, yeah, we're going to organize that place. And if they really can move, we're going to dog them. We're going to follow them. That's why the international labor movement, the labor movement has to be international. Because if a company thinks it can flee to a safe haven, as this says, investors are fleeing to safety, meaning safe havens. We, the labor movement, we working people need to be organized all over the world. That's part of the basics of socialism, by the way. And there's a material reason for that because capital, even going back to the 1800s, is all over the world. So, quoting this article again, next recession will destroy millennials, quite dramatic headline. A sputtering economy means miserable financial, emotional, and physical health consequence for everyone. In other words, a recession from infants to retirees. But the next one, if it happens, it will happen, when it starts happening, stands to hit this much maligned generation particularly hard. For adults between the ages of 22 and 38, after all, the last recession never really ended. So listen to that sentence. That's very interesting. From the Atlantic Monthly, you know, a corporate magazine. For adults between the ages of 22 and 38, the last recession never really ended. Very interesting. Now, I would say that is reality. Now, I wouldn't limit it to people between 22 and 38 because I'm older than that. My partner is older than that. And yet, the last recession never ended for us. It got worse. Millennials got blood. do you find, by the way, a lot more typos in corporate media now than used to happen? The answer is yes. It's a rhetorical question. Because they're not hiring as many people now, and they're doing more, they believe in spell check or something. Millennials got bodied in the downturn. It's supposed to be bloodied here, that wrote this in the again, Atlantic, Reuters, or whatever combination of evil put it together. Although it's good information, some of it. Millennials got bloodied in the downturn, have struggled in the recovery, and are now left more vulnerable than other older age cohorts. I'm not so sure about that. As they pitch toward middle age, they're failing to make it to the middle class. And there's a hyperlink, which I didn't do, to defining middle class. That's a whole other question. We've talked about that on the show before. How do you define middle class? You have people, literally, PhDs, supposedly smart people, saying the middle class is anyone that makes... I've actually read this, believe it or not. Anyone that makes from 20,000-something to 80,000-something. Do you know the difference between someone that makes 80,000 something and someone that makes 20,000 something is it, I mean, I don't even want to talk about it. It is a severe, severe gulf. Now, if you want to include all of them as working class, I can buy into that depending on what they actually do, right? And how they actually make their money. That's a reality. The working class has different sections to it. But to call those people middle class, believe me, someone making $30,000 a year is not middle class. I don't care what planet are you living on to even talk about that, or $40,000 even. And by the way, in the real world, people have to run around like myself and talk to people begging for financial aid for things based on my gross income. And every time I do that, I just want to go crazy because my gross income is so much more than my net income. Net income is what happens after taxes and deductions. And I started off the show talking about all the money I'm paying for insurance and for fees that should be covered by insurance under healthcare, right? And that you cannot explain, right, to people you're trying to get. I just tried to get financial aid for my daughter to do an extracurricular activity, and they just hated me for it. The place didn't even want to talk to me because supposedly I make more than the people they give financial aid to, which is like dirt poor people that, and I don't begrudge them that. That's great. But, you know, you leave out like, a good, 60% of the population that still needs financial aid for your thing. And you're not even looking at them. So I've tried to find my way around. I'm like to this place. I'm like, well, okay. So you have a payment plan, right? How about if you like let us do the payment plan? They had set schedule for the payment plan of months. So I said, well, how about if we just do an extra month on the payment plan and skip one of the earlier months? Because like everyone else, practically, I'm in debt. We're in debt. My family's in debt, and we're constantly trying to come up with cash for things we're being charged for that we shouldn't be charged for, you know? So, and your kids want stuff, you know, and you want to try to give them something, right? So, and kids are very malleable. One thing about children that's just so wonderful is that they'll make the best of a bad situation every time. It's amazing, their resiliency, as they say. I'm being cliched here, but it is just amazing, you know, because you're sitting there feeling like you just failed because your kid doesn't have all the lessons and all the schooling and all the stuff you need, and like and they're making the best of it. They really are. They find a way to think about it that's a lot more healthy. And I'm not saying that's the total answer or anything, because hey kid, hopefully you understand it's not fair you don't get the same stuff that or access to the same stuff that other people get. But that's another discussion you don't necessarily have too much with really young kids, but it's still true. But anyway, the point is that I'm begging, you know, just hey, just move this payment 1 month into the future from your last payment. It'll still be the same number of payments, and it'll be within your schedule by only one month outside of your schedule. I didn't even get an email promised me twice. Oh yeah, I'll send you an email. Twice I got promised an email, actually three times, and never appeared. And I called once. They said, don't call back anymore. Thank you very much. Even though we weren't fighting or anything, it was a perfectly pleasant conversation. They said, no, don't call, because we'll send you an email. And I should have said, well, you said that twice already. But okay, thanks. You know, I never get the email. So I just say to my daughter, hey, we're not going to try this place anymore. I'm sorry that you really wanted to go there and do this thing, but we can't do that. Sorry. You know, you have that. I have that discussion every year, many times. And that's just unfortunate, you know. And then we're obsessed as a culture, if you want to use this. I don't like generalizations like this too much, but I'm going to use it. We're obsessed as a culture with celebrity and people that have become very talented, you know. And again, it goes back to what I said earlier about like people have said that under socialism there'll be, you know, millions of Einsteins, not just one, you know, or thousands, let's say. Because people will have full access, full education, the time, leisure time to study and develop their talents and so on. That is impossible under capitalism. And with the resources you need to do that. And it's the same way under capitalism, not the same way, but it's under capitalism. You have this dynamic where I see a lot of talent completely wasted, completely never developed, never even started to develop. Because there's no time, because the parents don't have the money. That's the main reason. But lack of time flows from that exploitation. because there's no information about it even. One thing I've discovered about working at Harvard, by working at Harvard and by certain people I've met and so on, outside of Harvard even, there's a whole like secret world for the rich out there. And I'm not just talking about gated communities with high security. I'm talking about like entire sports that are so expensive to play that it effectively keeps out the riffraff, you know? And keeps those sports small, right? But you know, that the rich like it that way. They like their exclusiveness. They like their elitism. Anyway, back to the millennials are screwed. The next downturn, let's see. They're likely to be the first generation of modern... no, that's not... Boy, I keep seeing this thing. First generation of modern American history to be worse off than their parents. That already happened, by the way, with the tail end of the boomers. So shut up about that. Anyway, it was the last downturn, the once a century Great Recession. Wait a minute. Why once a century? All right. Anyway, that's not true either. That set them on this dottery economic course. Millennials graduated to the worst job market in 80 years. That did not just mean a few years of high unemployment or a couple years living in their parents' basements. It meant a full decade of lost wages. The generation unlucky enough to enter into the labor market in a recession suffers significant, this is in quotes and underlined, earnings losses. That take years and years to rebound. I can personally testify to that. I graduated into a recession after college, and I've never rebounded from that. Studies show something that hard data now back up. As of 2014, millennial men were earning no more than Gen X men were when they were the same age, and 10% less than baby boomers, despite the economy being far bigger and the country far richer. Well, the rich people, the big corporations being far richer. Millennial women were earning less than Gen X women. Kids of the 1980s and 90s have a huge financially catastrophic demand on their meager post-recession earnings to $1 trillion of educational debt. About a quarter of Gen Xers who went to college took out loans to do so compared with half of millennials. Wait a minute. And millennials ended up taking out double the amount of loans that Gen Xers did. No wonder, given that the cost of tuition has gone up more than 100% since 2001, even after accounting for inflation. We talked about that earlier in the show. The toxic combination of lower earnings and higher student loan balances combined with tight credit in the recovery years has led to millennials getting shut out of the housing market and thus losing a seminal way to build wealth. That's interesting. Now let's talk about that in a second. But the generation's home ownership rate is a full 8 percentage points lower than that of the Gen Xers or the baby boomers when they were the same age. The median age of home buyers has risen all the way to 46. Wow, whoa, listen to that one. The median age of home buyers has risen all the way to 46. Now, I can testify, being old, that there were people buying homes in their 20s and early 30s on a regular basis during the post-war upswing. Wow, median age 46. Oh, my goodness. The oldest it has been since, when we talk about buying homes, this includes condos. This includes crappy homes in crappy places. You know, I mean, this shouldn't, you know, the United States is big enough that there's a lot of structures out there, you know, and you can call anything a home practically, you know, as I've learned the hard way. You can move into a place that needs, you know, $60,000 in hidden repairs. And you're stuck with it, you know, in many ways. By the way, listen to this again. Generation's home ownership rate, that's the millennials, is full 8% lower than that of the Gen Xers or the baby boomers when they were the same age. The median age of home buyers has risen all the way to 46. That 46 thing I'd not heard about before. The oldest it has been since the National Association of Realtors started keeping records 4 decades ago. Ouch. Oh, my goodness. What I want to see on here, which I don't think is on here, I read this before, but I'm not sure what, I don't think it's here, is how much the general homeownership rate is in the United States, the percentage of people that own homes. That was falling recently. I wonder what it's at now. It's higher than you might think. I think it was like 61% or something, or I have to double check that. I think it's lower than that. Anyway, but that includes everything. All the things you can imagine as a home. So millennials have not benefited from the dramatic rebound in housing prices overall since the financial collapse. They've been forced to shell out hundreds of billions of dollars in rent as housing costs have skyrocketed in many urban areas. In this case, housing costs meaning paying rent. This represents a large generational transfer of wealth from the young to the old. Again, gotta be careful with this stuff because what old? Who? What part of the old? Well, you're talking about the capitalists. You're talking about the big landlords. Boomers own the houses and bar municipalities from building more of them. That's not really true in a lot of cases, thus benefiting from rising prices and soaking up endless rent checks forked over by younger and poorer families. Cost pressures have also made it difficult or impossible for millennials to save or invest. The share of Americans under 35 who own stocks has meandered down from, well, you're not going to make money on stocks, but anyway, we'll go with this article here, and from their point of view, has meandered down from 55% 2001 to 37% 2018, in part because employers are less likely to offer retirement savings plans, and in part because millennials have nothing left over at the end of the month to put away. Virtually all members of the cohort are not saving adequately. Experts warn 2/3 of millennials have zero retirement savings. Again, I think this is all good information you can use about the future under capitalism. But again, this is happening throughout the population, older people included. Because we're not going to have time to get to it, but I have an article I meant to get to in a previous show that I kind of, for some reason, put towards the back. I shouldn't have, of the strange political silence on elder care. I think because I might have gone over that in a show, but I wanted to revisit it, that elder care is a hugely expensive, freakishly expensive, crisis-ridden thing in the United States now that has been deregulated, and it's now the Wild West of, well, let's put it that way. If you read The Grapes of Wrath, let's put it this way. If you read The Grapes of Wrath by John Steinbeck, the opening of that book is a Dust Bowl family whose farm has been ruined by the Depression and the resultant, and this resonates with our age, the resultant climate catastrophe, a lot of it resulting from farming practices, by the way, of the Dust Bowl. So they're leaving Oklahoma, I think it was. And this is what Steinbeck's focusing on, The Grapes of Wrath, this family leaving Oklahoma. And, oh, they're starting down the road, and they left behind the grandparents to die. That's what it used to be, you know. When the Democrats and the Republicans and everybody starts talking about, a lot of Democrats and Republicans start, a lot of Republicans start talking about attacking Social Security. Social Security came about because older people just died because they had no way to survive, all right? And the mass movement of the 30s, that was a pre-revolutionary movement in many, many senses, and that didn't quite reach that, but it was building towards that. The growth in the left, the growth in the Communist Party, the threat of independent political action, despite the Roosevelt administration getting reelected time and again, there was a large movement for a new workers' party of some sort. The big strikes, the big strike actions that terrified the capitalists, the plant occupations, the workplace occupations, terrified them. They coughed up some of the New Deal, quote unquote, social reforms, which were solidified through strike action and unions growing and stuff in the 40s and into the 50s. And that all resulted in things like Social Security, unemployment insurance, things that didn't exist before, including things for elderly people. And then in the 50s and 60s, regulations around elder care. You had municipally owned hospitals, municipally owned elder care facilities. That stuff is gone. It's been privatized for the most part, or maybe totally. I don't know. I don't know the figures of if totally is correct or not. And nobody thinks about this. Elder care, far away, you know. My parents seem healthy. My grandparents seem pretty healthy. All of a sudden something happens. Boom. You go to a nursing homes are, as they call them, elder care facilities, whatever, they're allowed to charge whatever they want. And the market rate is up around $14,000, $15,000 a month. How many people have $14,000 or $15,000 a month? They don't have it. They lose everything. They go through any assets they might have, and they use them. Then they go after anything else they get their hands on. And usually what happens is the person is dirt poor and living in a rotten situation. Something in the article triggered that little riff there. But let's go back to the article real quick. Toxic combination of lower earnings and higher student loan balances combined with tight credit. Oh, I already talked about that. Homeownership rate, da-da. Cost pressures have made it more difficult for millennials to save or invest. Talked about that. Millennials are worth less on paper than members of older generations are, and are worth less on paper than members of older generations were at some point in their lives. Now, the thing that gets me about this, the thing that makes me think about, is that our expectations as working people in the United States, and I'd say as youth as well, not speaking as a youth, but do organizing, among young people, colleges and in areas around the country. Well, I mean, basically in Worcester, around the country. I have been in other places around the country doing organizing. Anyway, so the thing that bothers me is our low expectations. We have very low expectations. Because if you think you're in heaven once you own a house, what owning a house means in U.S. terms and in many other countries around the world under capitalism, it means the bank owns the house and you're paying a mortgage plus incredibly usurious interest that should immediately put the banker in prison for even thinking of charging you that much interest on a home loan. That's what the reality is. That plus all your other debt, you know, healthcare, college, fixing the home, maintaining the home. Not too many people have their homes paid off. And once you have your home paid off, do you think you're all clear? I figured it out. I got the American dream. I got the house. I paid it off. Your property taxes, you might be living in a place where housing values are increasing so much that only the rich can move in. Once the rich move in, you're dead. Because they're going to keep raising property taxes that they can eat, they can pay, that's going to cause you as a working person to have to move. You just have to move. You cannot pay the property taxes. You cannot pay the water bills. You cannot pay all the other stuff that they jack up on you. And the house you struggled and sacrificed for really hard to own, you still don't own at the end of the day, because the government, local government controlled by the frickin' businesses and the big corporations, are going to screw you bad on taxes, and they're going to screw you bad on fees, whether it's water fees or whatever else they want to come up with, and you're going to have to move. And you're going to have to go out and take, if you saved any money, if you can get any money for that house, and buy a smaller thing. You know, that so-called downsizing you hear about sounds real nice. It's only happening to a lot of people because they have to move from places that are being gentrified. And that's not just happening in the cities. Not because there's that many rich people running around, but because, you know, there's certain parts of the country where there are jobs. So, you know, some jobs, or the perception is there are some jobs, so people go to them, and it creates a high demand. Again, capitalism is unplanned. Capitalism is anarchic, you know? If you want to be an anarchist, you should love capitalism because it's so freaking anarchic, you know? It is just not a planned economy. There's no accountability, you know? Surf the wave of the market. See what happens. Let's see. End of this article. There's more good stats. I recommend the article overall, despite its biases. Millennials missed out on the big asset boom that occurred between 2010 and the present. Asset, that's basically talking about houses for most people. Again, with all the problems I just mentioned with that. The next recession, this year, next year, whenever it comes, will likely make those millennial disadvantages even worse. Millennials have they've put off savings and buying homes. They've put off getting married and having babies. Because of their crummy jobs and weighty student loans, make it extremely difficult. A downturn that leads to higher unemployment and lower wages will force millennials to wait even longer to start accumulating wealth. And I put that in quotes, they don't. Making it far harder for them to accumulate any wealth at all. Compound interest is magic, after all. Oh, that's another hyperlink. I wish it was in the article, because I'm not doing this from online. And there's a thing here... compound interest. If you dip in your credit cards to survive, like a lot of people have to, you find out soon they can just raise interest rates to whatever. So there's people with credit card debt paying 25% interest on credit card debt, 18-19% interest on credit card debt. That recent thing one of the candidates, I think it was Sanders, one of the Democratic Party candidates, brought up about limiting... Maybe it was Warren, limiting interest rates. Maybe it was both of them. Limiting interest rates on, and that's not a plug for them, by the way, because they're not going to get it. Limiting interest rates on the credit cards to like 15%. That's 15% is hot. That's robbery. That's nasty usury. That is, again, an imprisonable offense in a decent society. Hey, so we're running out of time here, but we wanted to get in that this electoral stuff seems to be unrelenting, of course. And part of the problem with that, other than the boredom and whatever, is the it just reinforces, every corporate media story reinforces this idea that there's no politics outside of the duopoly of the Democratic and Republican parties. But there is. And we mentioned before a member of Social Alternative who, named Shama Sawant, K-S-H-A-M-A, last name Sawant, S-A-W-A-N-T, was elected in 2013 as an independent socialist candidate, as a, you know, Social Alternative on the ballot for city council in Seattle, a major city in the U.S., and has been reelected once is it twice already, or reelected once, and now running for reelection again. And there's a good article in, Socialist Alternatives, July, August 2019 issue. Don't let billionaires bust Seattle's socialist, oust Seattle's socialist, the national importance of the Shama Sawant reelection campaign. And this is by Brian Koulouris. And a little history. Shama Sawant was first elected to the Seattle City Council in 2013 with over 90,000 votes, running as a proud Socialist Alternative member back before Bernie and AOC were household names. Shama used her 2000 election campaign to advocate strongly for the $15 an hour minimum wage, when no prominent elected officials were talking about that, despite ongoing fast food worker strikes. Also, by the way, not in the article here, but there was a movement near Seattle that was overturned by the courts, but almost won a $15 minimum wage, and Social Alternative and Shama were involved in that. But it wasn't until Shama got elected, and afterwards, right afterwards, that 15 became the law. Seattle was the first major city to win the $15 minimum wage. The $15 movement in Seattle overcame fierce opposition from the corporate establishment, but after the victory in Seattle, the $15 legislation spread like wildfire across the country. Shama's 2013 election was also the first big breakthrough for socialists at the ballot box, giving confidence to other left activists they could defeat corporate power and the political establishment, and was reinforced through Sawant's re-election in 2015. So this is now the attempt for a second re-election. There's a re-election campaign going on. We've started to talk about in some shows, the way that the campaign was opened up to hundreds of volunteers and to the labor movement and other community movements, the way that since getting elected, Shama and Social Alternative and others have used that office in a way to mobilize people. They use the office mainly as a platform to organize people from. That's the key of having one socialist on the city council has accomplished a ton in Seattle, because when you have that, when you fill City Hall, literally, like Social Alternative and Shama has done numerous times in Seattle, it puts pressure on whoever's in office. And in Seattle, it's all Democrats, except for Shama. And Democrats who recently did a nasty thing, all but one of them voted to repeal a small tax on Amazon's profits in Seattle, because that's where the headquarters of Amazon and Microsoft and all these other huge corporations. And there's a huge housing crisis in Seattle and so on. I don't have time in today's show to go into all the details, but check it out. Go to shamasawant.org. Just Google Shama Sawant, K-S-H-A-M-A, Sawant, S-A-W-A-N-T. But I wanted to, the reason it's national importance is that even in these times of the duopoly cementing itself, seemingly, in the United States, and only a few socialists and Marxists standing up to that and saying, no, we still need a workers' party, we still need independent politics and mass movements, and that will be the way, those will be the ways, the mass movements coupled with independent politics that will bring the change like we got with 15 in Seattle, and then that moved nationwide, you know? The Democrats have tried to usurp that demand, Sanders on down, if you want to look at it that way, but they've not created and never will create mass movements around it. That's going to come from the labor movement. It's going to come from the socialist movement. It's going to come from other community movements and so on. But what you can do if you run as an independent socialist, and there's independent socialists running in an election in Ohio right now. I had their names last time. I don't have it this time. Sorry for that. There's independent. There's left Greens gearing up to run now and in 2020. Howie Hawkins. Google Howie Hawkins. See what he's got to say. He's an eco-socialist. He's gotten decent votes in running for governor. I believe it was in New York and also New Jersey at one point recently. He was a Teamster. He's recently retired. You're going to see some people, and these are the people to watch out for, to support, to hook up with, that are not going to buy the duopoly, right? They're not going to buy it. They're going to still fight for independent politics. And that's really, really important to keep that alive, because not until there is a clear alternative being built that people will abandon lesser evilism voting. And if you say, well, not this time because of Trump, then you're just doing what everyone's done. Take my word for it. Research it, please. But take my word for it. What's been done in the left since the 1930s, when the Communist Party under Stalin and became Stalinized, it said, hey, we're going to support Democrats here and there, the ones we like, because that's what Stalinism was doing all over the world, basically. They were saying they were trying to consolidate their position in Russia, not through spreading revolution anymore, but through getting the best deal they could through liberal politicians in the social democracies in Europe and in the United States that took the form of the Democratic Party, even though it's not at all a social democratic party. Ever since then, there's been elements of the left that have periodically slid down into the trap of the Democratic Party, whether it's around, there's so many examples, but FDR himself, that's sucked in a lot of so-called socialists into his campaign, into his advisors even, you know, even though he was openly saying, I'm doing this to save capitalism and et cetera, and all the problems with the New Deal and all the racism of the Roosevelt administration allying itself with Jim Crow and the internment of the Japanese Americans in the West and so on. On and on, we've talked about that on the show before. Take the slightest honest look at the Roosevelt administration, and there's horror after horror there, despite the general idea that, hey, this New Deal thing happened, and it solved the problem of the Depression. Well, no, actually, mass movements threatening capitalism in the United States through the labor movement, through a radicalized left-led labor movement, for the most part, not totally, threatened capitalism. Planned occupations threatened capitalism. Growth of the left threatened capitalism. And it wasn't until the production coming out of World War II that the Depression even ended. Didn't end like a clockwork 1939 end of the Depression. Didn't work that way. It took actually nationalization of, or at least heavy regulation and pushing from the national government for war production that led to higher employment and was a stimulus to the economy temporarily. It could have all ended after World War II, but the labor movement was strong enough to push. There was a general strike in Oakland in 1946. Read about that. Labor movement was strong enough. The left was strong enough then, even in the United States, to push for not a rollback of everything that had been gained in the 30s and into the 40s, but to extend that. And there was a big fight. McCarthyism is part of that fight. Don't have time to go into that right now. What I wanted to get back into, though, was look at the Shama Sawan campaign for its example of using, organizing, building small mass movements within the context of Seattle and surrounding areas to pressure a pro-business Democratic Party domination over the city council there. So, for example, quoting from an article about Shama Sawant's victories, and I don't mean to personalize it. This is of a, you know, Social Alternative and other left groups and individual activists and community groups and some unions that have supported Shama and so on. But if you're shorthand, I'll say Shama Sawant sometimes. What's at stake in this re-election is who runs Seattle. Amazon and big business are working people. You can't serve two bosses. You can't be accountable to big business and to working people at the same time. Already, corporate PACs have amassed an unprecedented war chest of $1 million with $200,000 from Amazon alone. This is actually old information. It's gone up since then. Business has made it clear it wants anybody but Shama Sawant for District 3. Now, this is what happens when, in any city, big or small, where a real socialist runs. I'm not talking about Democrats that call themselves socialists. I'm not talking about DSA Democrats that call themselves socialists. I'm talking about real independent movements and candidates that often come up from those movements through and not through the Democratic or Republican parties, but as independents. Maybe left greens, maybe in not having a party affiliation, but they're independents, maybe a small party, whatever. If they catch on, if they start to get a lot of support, then everything will be turned on them from big business. That's why you have to grow that movement. You have to, I hate that word, grow the movement. You have to organize that movement beyond where you're at. So just some examples from Shama herself. She said, when I was first elected, our calls for 15 now were dismissed as impossible. We brought together the Coalition for 15 Non-Existing of Unions, Community Organizations, Social Alternative, and Ordinary Work People to make Seattle the first major city country to win a $15 minimum wage. Now, I already mentioned that. Sorry, I'm talking fast because of time pressures. We already mentioned that, but I have to stress, I actually was out there for some of that, filling City Hall, right? Filling public protest areas with people fighting for this, not just, you know, trying to cobble together some sort of agreement, like to be honest, that what the unions want to do is what they always do, just lobby Democrats, and that was going nowhere, and they'd already lost a court case on that next door to Seattle in a small city next door to Seattle. So I'm like, you know, we're like, this is ridiculous, and ran a mass movement instead. Use the election energy to build a mass movement. Now that's happening in other cities now, and some cities and states have taken on 15. Now, you're wondering, perhaps you're wondering why you haven't heard more about that, because a lot of the, unfortunately, a lot of the $15 an hour, when they reach a certain height or strength, they get co-opted by the Democrats, and people get so, even people that are organizing it, are so into, like, trying to get something that they're like, they let Democrats kind of rewrite the legislation or the law. And that unfortunately happened with the legislation in Seattle to a certain extent, but not as bad as in other places where these phase-ins, quote-unquote, happened, where, hey, you're going to get 15, but not right away, stuff like that. That's going to come in later. Under pressure, let's see. So there's a lot about 15 now. We won a series of landmark renters' rights victories. The move-in fee cap. They have this move-in fee out in Seattle, which is a huge housing crisis. You wonder why, with move-in fee plus first month, last month, et cetera. The Carl Hagelin law, barring rent increases at substandard rental homes. That's like a slum anti-slumlord law. The Fair Chance Housing Bill to limit the use of criminal records in rental housing applications. And a law requiring landlords to provide voter registration information to new tenants. Now, all that, and then there's a discussion of all those things. We stopped the Seattle Housing Authority's Orwellian stepping forward public housing tax, which would have raised rents by 400%. That's true, believe it or not. They wanted to quietly raise rents in public housing to force people out of them, basically. The Shama Sawant campaign, the Social Alternative, and others got a hold of that, publicized it, and, of course, got hundreds of people in the city hall, and that was very unpopular. And now Shama's running for re-election on, and then the whole campaign's running for re-election on rent control and building more public housing and you know, resources for the homeless and so on. But here's the main point I want to get through here. We have completely transformed the dynamic of City Hall, regularly bringing in hundreds of ordinary working people in town halls and rallies to win major victories for people. I've seen this. I've seen this. And the thing is, the Democrats, even if they want to do that, they often can't. They don't go out and organize among the people. Their answer is, vote for me. I will put legislation through. Vote for other Democrats. We will put legislation through, and we will win that way. That's not the starting point for socialists. The starting point for, or I'll say good socialists, real socialists, in office is the office itself is the election campaign itself. The office itself is a campaigning platform to organize working people. That's where the strength is. It's not the backroom deal. It's not the lobbying. During my first year in office, we shattered a decades-long tradition during Seattle's budget season. Instead of using taxpayer money to attend a retreat hosted by Seattle's Corporate Chamber of Commerce, I called it out as a clear display of brazen corporate favoritism, quoting Shama Sawant, and organized our first annual People's Budget. Each year, we have fought back against police militarization and austerity policies from the corporate establishment, winning millions in funding for affordable housing and programs to prioritize racial, gender, and social justice, while at the same time demanding progressive funding sources. Through the People's Budget, we have won tens of millions of dollars in funding for affordable housing, including fighting alongside the Block the Bunker. That was a city, that was a new police boondoggle thing, new police headquarters they want, struggle in launching the Build 1,000 Homes Coalition to stop the mayor and city council majority, Democrats, by the way, all, from wasting wasting $160 million of public funds on further militarizing the police, instead winning $29 million for affordable housing. And there are links to a lot of this stuff in the article I'm reading from. Let's put that article out there. Let's say www.shamasawant.org victories. Check that out. Anyway, running out of time, I'll list a couple more. Funding for critical jobs programs, including expanding the LEAD program citywide, which directs low-level offenders into community-based treatment and supportive services. Important gains for the LGBTQ community, including funding for an LGBTQ senior center in the heart of Capitol Hill, funding for an LGBTQ wellness center at Nova High School, and a backfill against cuts made by Mayor Jenny Durkan, a Democrat, by the way, cuts to services for the trans community to stop those cuts. Funding for the first eviction defense attorney in the city's history to provide valued support for tenants facing evictions, as well as tenants' education and organizing through organizations like the Tenants Union. A $15 minimum wage for all city workers as an important precursor to the implementation of the, so that happened even before the law went through, $15 citywide, as well as wage raises for workers at Seattle Human Services Coalition, et cetera. Millions in funding for crucial social services, including funding for the YWCA homeless shelter, programs serving survivors of domestic violence, funding for food for kids, more shelter space for women's shelter, increased shelter hours for homeless people, saving Seattle's essential urban rest stop from the mayor's cuts, restoring Share Wheel, King County's largest shelter network, in response to cuts from the corporate establishment, and $1 million for the Orca passes for low income, middle, and that's a transportation thing, I believe. And also, the Shaman Smart Campaign is calling for free mass transit and totally electrified, you know, non fossil fuel based mass transit in Seattle. So, just want to give a glimpse into the fact that, yeah, the next recession is going to hit working people really hard, and the way to prevent some of that damage in the short term and the way in the long term to get rid of recessions is to bite the bullet, fight hard for independent politics, even when everyone's crying in the corporate media for and in among your, you know, better off liberal friends perhaps or wherever, about all that matters is getting Democrats elected, supporting one half of the duopoly. It's not all that matters. We need to be organizing for a workers' party now, for something that people can vote for without falling into the trap of lesser evilism time after time after time after time again. So that is all we have time for, really. We're going to got to get ready for the next person to come in. And we missed some things we wanted to cover. Always happens. Almost always. There was one show recently where I like covered everything, but that's not usually the case because there's so much to talk about. And we will see you in a couple weeks, and we will thank you for listening to Socialist Alternative Radio, talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. Again, thanks for your time, and go to WMFO.org. Go to our Facebook page, Socialist Alternative Radio's Facebook page, also for more information. Usually throw up content there, almost new content every day. Socialist Alternative Radio on Facebook. Go to socialistalternative.org for more information about socialism in general. And again, purpose of this show is to get you interested in becoming a socialist, to move beyond corporate politics and to move beyond the corporate domination over our lives. And we hope you can get behind that. And we look forward to working with you on that. Thanks for listening. Sky.